want more species? Where are we from?
Life is rooted in Death's Republic.
Where are we going?
Our seat returns to Death's Republic. These cheery sentiments should inspire.
Okay, so welcome back to the sixth episode in the Grey Matters podcast series. Today we're going to be looking at Lanark in real life and fantasy, and I'm delighted to be joined today by Dan Fox. Dan is a writer, musician and filmmaker living in New York, and he is the author of two books, Pretentiousness, White Matters and Limbo, both published by Fitzcarraldo Editions. Small Country Eclipse's most recent album with the band The Gordon Hackney is out on Junior Aspen Records, and he is the recipient of an Andy Warhol Foundation Arts Writers Grant for 2021. So Dan, thank you very much for joining me today, all the way from New York. Good to see you.
Nice to be here.
Yeah. Well, could we start off maybe by you sharing a little bit about when you first read Lanark, what your thoughts were, how it maybe impacted you?
So I think it was sometime around 2001 or 2002. So probably the last, you know, the 20th anniversary of Lanark coming out. And at that time, I remember, you know, I was just a couple of years out of art school, and I was just a couple of years into a job working as an editor and critic for Frieze, the art magazine. And you know, I've always had a big interest in literature and fiction. And I think at that time, as I seem to remember, casting my mind back, I seem to remember having lots of conversations with friends about our frustrations that the only things you kind of read about in the, you know, certainly like the London press that were kind of connected with literature was always to do with the same, you know, Martin Amis, Ian McEwan, Salman Rushdie, Julian Barnes sort of area of literature, all kind of, you know, endless sort of like fussing over, you know, the 19th century novel. And it didn't really sort of, it sort of didn't really speak to me, and I was sort of looking for something else. And at that time, I had been trying to sort of, I'd been exploring, you know, a few of the sort of odder corners of science fiction. I'd recently read Ridley Walker by Russell Hoban, you know, a great post-apocalyptic novel set in sort of post-apocalyptic Kent. And some stranger corners of sort of mid-century British literature, like Brigid Brophy and B.S. Johnson. And this is like before, you know, the Jonathan Coe biography of B.S. Johnson came out, and I'd been sort of searching down secondhand copies of his novels, which I suppose, you know, I was later to discover, as with Alistair Gray's work, you know, there's a lot of kind of, there are a lot of games, there are lots of kind of, you know, meta-narrative jokes and gags in B.S. Johnson, which, you know, I sort of found quite fun at the time, just because it was just sort of a bit different to everything else. And yeah, I remember reading an interview with Alistair, and I'd never ever heard of him before. And a few things just leapt out. The first was that he'd written what was described in this interview as like a science, you know, a dystopian science fiction novel set in Glasgow, which immediately was like, that sounds amazing. What could that possibly be? Secondly, I think his politics attracted me. You know, he was in this interview, I remember, you know, him sort of talking about, you know, his left wing and, you know, sort of beliefs in socialism and a kind of welfare state. And thirdly, the other thing that really attracted me to him was, well, you know, I've always been attracted by artists or creative people who work across a lot of different fields. You know, people who are novelists and painters, you know, and musicians or whatever. I think you know that appeals to me a lot as a way to, not just as a from a creative point of view, but also as a way of living a life, you know, and a way of living a kind of interesting, varied life. And, you know, I've always been interested in how people pull that off or how people do that. So I tracked down this copy of Lanark from a bookshop, and the And I began reading it, and I just couldn't, I couldn't put it down. I could also not stop talking about it. I became a kind of, for a very brief moment, a kind of absolute Lanik evangelist. I was telling every single friend I had about this book, and giving people copies for their book. I was probably a complete bore about Lanik. But I think I did turn a couple of friends, you know, onto his work, and, you know, and from there, you know, I read Poor Things after that, and in swift succession, you know, read as much as I could get my hands on. But it was at that point, and subsequently looking back, I think it's hard for me to think of another book that has caught my imagination so immediately in my adult life as Lanik. And, you know, in the experience of reading it has that first time around has stuck with me.
What was it about that? I mean, you're obviously talking about you were reading a lot of the time sort of sci-fi and you're into that. You know, was it seeing how he, I guess, he's fusing these sort of different genres together in a way? Or what was it, what was the thing that kind of, that you're saying kind of captured or made it stay with you? So,
well, there's so much, I think, yeah, the fusion of genres, the fusion of the fantastical with this sort of very, very kind of kitchen sink realist narrative seemed quite original to me. And I think the humor in it probably was something that appealed. And also, I suppose the sense of the specificity of it, the localism of it, you know, to do with Glasgow. I mean, something I often think about, you know, living here. I've been living in New York for 10 years. Well, gosh, 11 years now. And before that, I was in London for 10 years. But before that, you know, I grew up in a small village, and then, you know, a small city. So, you know, I often think about parochialism and how, you know, somewhere like New York, for instance, or London, you know, they always imagine, they sort of speak as if they are the center of the world, but they're as parochial as everywhere else. You know, everywhere is very local. And it just depends to the extent on which, you know, these places sort of project their own importance and sense of, you know, kind of cosmic self-absorption and self-obsession. And I think the thing that I liked about the world that Alistair was creating with Lanik was that he was making something out of his immediate surroundings, which I think we, you know, it feels like a very, I think we all do that to a degree. You know, you work with what you've got, you work with what's immediately around you, and I think we do that you know, from childhood onwards. You know, the small world that you inhabit as a child grows as you grow older, but still you're only sort of pulling from what's immediately around you, and that becomes the universe. And, you know, you can, for, you know, every imaginative child can see an entire universe in the, you know, the grass and the trees and the sky. And I think that that's something which we perhaps forget that we're doing as adults, but we do continue to do. And I think there was something really incredible about just the confidence with which Alistair sort of, you know, you used Glasgow as this material to kind of create this very, very big allegory.
Yeah. I wonder if more people celebrate that now, just given current circumstances, where you're small. We were just talking about that before we started recording, you know, that small map that you are in constantly, and how you start to then maybe notice details or celebrate or shine a spotlight on the small, more incidental, overlooked things that you were maybe too busy to kind of recognize. Or
I think that's a good point. And I think that you know, that also speaks to the kind of the you know, the great power of creative constraints. You know, you make something as a creative person, you know, you make something with what materials you have access to, whether that's, you know, cardboard and a bit of sellotape, or whether it's, you know, a big studio with, you know, all the kind of resources you need. But having some kind of creative constraints, I think, is often much, much better for making something than having, you know, all the materials in the world at your disposal.
Yeah. Yeah, interesting. It's rooted back in the domestic space, right? And how that is often overlooked as a space of, I guess, creativity, or, you know, and Alistair was very domestic, you know, he lived and worked in the same space. And I think for many people now that being able to sort of understand how they can use a domestic space in a different way. And of course, there's obviously the history and the politics around all of that, and domestic working or unpaid labour, you know, ties in with unpaid labour and politics and lots of other things, doesn't it? But it seems...
Yeah. I think so also, you know, the... Especially with, you know, within art, there's a, you know, the visual arts, you know, there's a sort of macho notion that, you know, the artist has to have a big studio where they make their big work, and, you know, that anything that's kind of to do with the domestic is, you know, has this sort of like, is sort of looked down upon, you know, and I think that that's an awful thing, because I think, you know, so many amazing things get made at the kitchen table, you know. And,
absolutely. Can you go back to when you did a reading for the Grade A series that was collecting, and you did a lovely introduction where you spoke about the cover. I think it was maybe the first book that your first edition of Lanark, where you talked about the cover, the Cowcaddens cover, and how that, you know, that you described it really beautifully with a sort of gloomy, eerie sort of cityscape, and how that, can you talk a bit about the sort of the, I guess, the connection with the literary and the visual then, and how that maybe, how what that made you think about or conjure up when you were sort of reading it, and then also looking at these images that were contained around and within it?
Yeah. So the first edition that I managed to track down, I would later discover, wasn't a very Alistair Gray type edition. You know, I think it was a Canongate classic or something. It was the one with like a very gray, plain cover and a sort of plain sort of serif font, a bit of a jaunty angle saying Lanark, and then this detail from the Cowcadden streetscape painting, and you know what of course, you know, not knowing much about, you know, anything really about Alistair, you know, when I picked it off the bookshelf, I was like, oh, that's an interesting, you know, painting from the 50s, I wonder what that is. And then I discovered that it was by him, you know, painted in the 60s actually, which piqued my interest further, because it was, you know, I hadn't seen the whole painting either, you know, and I didn't know anything about it, but that just that detail, which is of the central part of the painting, and it's got, there are two figures in the foreground, a man and a woman, and then a street sort of like rising in a very exaggerated perspective behind them, and then this really, really dark, dark, gloomy atmosphere. A few things happened in my head at that point. I think, you know, every day picking up the book and then seeing that painting on the cover. I think first, immediately, the character of Slodden, who Lanark encounters in the elite cafe, you know, the guy who's sort of at the heart of this particular clique, he immediately got pegged as the male figure in that painting. For some reason, that immediately sort of became how he looked in my mind's eye. And, you know, this sort of strange sense of twilight, a sort of continuous, infinite twilight that never breaks into day, you know, sort of over, like very heavy skies, when you're not really sure if it's to do with pollution or some sort of terrible kind of ecological, you know, catastrophe, or, you know, some terrible accident in the earth, sort of, you know, rotation around the sun that means it's like forever dark in this place. You know, when you, although that painting is ostensibly a sort of very sort of, you know, it's just a realist painting in a way, it immediately got imbued with all these sort of, you know, more fantastical and science fictional elements for me. There's something about that painting style too, which has elements that you can sort of later see very sort of inimitably Alistair. But that, the way in which like the figures and the shading, you know, the volumes are kind of modeled in a very sort of careful sort of way, you know, is very, very much of a piece with a kind of early first half of the 20th century sort of modernist painting. And it evoked lots of things in my head. It reminded me of the cover of a copy of 1984 that I had, which had a painting by William Roberts called The Control Room, Civil Defense HQ. And the figures in that are a bit more kind of, they look a bit more like, say, like a Fernand Léger painting, these sort of cylindrical volumes. But there was something about the atmosphere of that Orwell cover that I connected up to the Lanark cover. Also, Winifred Knight's painting, The Deluge, which hangs in Tate Britain in London. These figures running up this big, big slope, escaping from a flood. You know, that looked, it looks a little bit like the Cowcaddens painting. And then, of course, when I get to the end of Lanark, you know, where there is the Great Deluge, you know, I'm thinking of that as well. Also, George Taylor's painting, The Subway, which is in the Whitney Museum collection here in New York, which I don't know if you know, it's this amazing painting of a figure in the New York subway, but just sort of lost amid this sort of maze of dark, heavy passageways and gates and fences. And, you know, it's this sort of nightmarish idea of like, you know, what the 20th century city was like. So lots of things were kind of flooding into my mind. Also, that first chapter, The Elite Cafe, for me at a very personal level, it reminded me of stories. My mum grew up in North Wales and she was a teenager in the 1950s. And she had lots of stories about going to coffee shops in like Pwllheli, in, you know, listening to things on the jukebox, you know, the latest rock and roll on the jukebox, or taking trips across to Liverpool to go to the cinema. And, you know, because the Elite Cafe is above a cinema and it's got this very 50s sort of feel to it, it was this, that made for a very strange, almost timeless quality for the world of Unthank. Unthank was sort of both the 1950s and the 2050s. You know, it was sort of both future and past at the same time. And I found that very, very powerful. It was both immediately kind of, it felt immediately kind of relatable to places I'd been. And yet, of course, you know, very alien and dark and sort of terrifying at the same time.
I guess that goes back to that idea you're talking about, using sort of the personal or the familiar, but then using that as a starting point to not connect universally, but to explore that, right, or really, or expand that out. So even though it seems familiar, there's this sort of dystopian or other sort of sense or feel that you get from it too. Where do you think it sits within more like the sci-fi sort of tradition in a way? Then you were talking about, you were reading a lot. Where would it fit, or does it, or?
I'm not sure if it does, and I think that's what's wonderful about it. You know, it almost doesn't even fit in with the you know, the sort of the tradition of the kind of post-apocalyptic novel or in sci-fi, or I even find it hard to describe it as a dystopian novel. Mm. Because there is so, you know, there are because I think the central kind of Duncan Thorne narrative, you know, although that's very tragic and has this sort of, you know, heaviness to it, you know, that also grounds everything very much back in the present, you know, in our lives, in the present, in a way that it stops the novel feeling like, oh, like, you know, say with like 1984, you know, it's like, oh, that's a Handmaid's Tale or whatever. It's like, oh, I can see some allegorical aspects of our current society in this, but it's a long way away. You know, like the Thor narrative kind of pulls it very much into our present. So I suppose in a way it's almost a bit like, it reminds me a little bit of a novel called Robinson that was written by the filmmaker Chris Pettit, who's probably best known for the movie Radio On. But he wrote this incredible, very overlooked, I think, novel in the 1990s called Robinson, which is set in London, and it's about a young man who's looking for film editing jobs, and he comes across this mysterious person called Robinson, who seems connected with government figures, establishment figures, in a slightly kind of shady way. And he gets more and more involved in this kind of shadow world of authority in London. But as the novel goes on, he keeps mentioning how it's raining, and it's raining more and more and more and more and more and more, until by the end of the novel, like, you realize London is being flooded. You know, there is this sort of terrible kind of ecological disaster going on. You know, and I don't know where I'd place that novel either, you know, if it's really strictly science fiction or what. It's, I find, speculative fiction is the better term for it.
But I guess you, like, now, I guess, as you were saying, and you're interested in that slipping between, you know, not being defined by one thing, being able to. I remember from talking to Alistair and other people at the time, it was like you at the time you had to be, you know, when he was writing Lanark or when it came out, you had to be defined. You couldn't be an art, you had to be one or the other. And you know, he was obviously very determined not to be, to be all those things. But I think it was often, now it's acceptable, isn't it, to slip between mediums and to you know, to not have to be defined by one thing. And I think it was probably just partly to do with the time, wasn't it, of having and now you can write, I guess you don't need to be, you can write or make works that can speak across a range of different genres and styles, and that's okay.
I think so, to a degree. I actually think that there's still people like to kind of like it if you stay, prefer it, you know, if you stick in your lane. I think with the visual arts world, I mean, I don't know what your experience was, but mine was that the art world talked a big game about multidisciplinary, you know, practices, but actually when it comes down to it, they prefer you know, if you're an artist who's got an interest in making music, still you're an artist, really. You know, the music is just something you're doing on the side. You know, the idea that the music you might make is a really serious practice in and of itself as music is very hard, I think, for a lot of people in the art world to get their head around. And I think that goes, I think that still stands to a certain degree, even though people like to sort of say, oh yeah, you know, I'm a, you know, hyphenate of some kind, you know, do lots of things. I think people still like to have a sense of what you are as a core person. And the idea that your core person might actually be a multitude, is still kind of hard for people to get their head around, because it disrupts the sort of usual systems by which we organise the world.
I guess that's what's exciting about Alistair and that work. It's a possibilities, you know, and what opens up. And I read an article that Janice Galloway had written about the book, and she said about it's, there was two things about persistence and this idea of being persistent and striving, you know, striving for something and failing within that, but this focus of getting somewhere, and you might not be fully aware of where, what that point is, the ultimate end point, but it's a desire to kind of keep going, which I think really kind of comes through. There, I mean, was that from reading Lanark then? You said you obviously went on to Poor Things and you read other novels and works by Alistair. Was that also when you discovered his visual practice and the side of that side of his work, or?
Yes, it was around then I sort of began to find out more. You know, there were a number of sort of things, I suppose, happening at the same time. I think it was around the time that Lucy McKenzie did the spoken word record with Alistair, and, you know, she was interested in his work. So sort of, you know, that was another route into the work, I suppose. But yeah, I mean, just buying the novels and seeing that each one had these amazing, you know, paintings on the cover, or these incredible designs inside, and so on. It just made me want to learn more. And then, I think, you know, it made me think about how all artists, to some degree, are world builders, aren't they? You know, and the act of making something, whether it's a novel or a you know, a painting or a film, it's a way of organizing the world around you, and organizing the materials around you. and you know, so you know, all artists are a bit controlling in that kind of sense, you know, for better and for worse, I think, as well, you know. And I think that what you know, Lanek very, very beautifully evokes is this idea of world build, you know, world building at the level of, like, you know, Alistair's vision of Unthank, but then at the level of, like, Duncan Thor and you know, and his sort of obsession with creating this mural about creation myth, you know, and trying to organize the world around him so that he can create this, you know, this big mural, in it, and showing how that desire is something that can benefit the world in certain ways, but also, you know, artists are complex people, and just like everyone else, mm-hmm. you know, and not necessarily good people always, or you know, they're you know, like everyone, you know, they're full of nuances and contradictions and paradoxes, and you know, and I think that Lanek is a really wonderful sort of allegory for that, for the successes and the failures of that kind of world building instinct that artists have. Yeah, I mean, I went on to discover more about Alistair's visual work, and then that tied into other things I was looking at, you know. I realized, like, how there's a sort of strange parallel between his portraiture and that of someone like Alice Neal, you know, and how, you know, it, again, it's about making the world around you. You painting the people who are your neighbors and your community and, you know, relatives and things like that. And that feels like a very, that just felt really right to me as a way of sort of, you know, being in the world as an artist.
Yeah. And is there, what sections do you prefer, the more fantastical elements or the more biographical? I mean, I know each time you read it, I guess there's different sections that might resonate, but yeah, what are your thoughts on the two?
I think that the it's about them working in tandem with each other, isn't it? You know, I think the whole novel is very realistic in a way, because, you know, this is a totally trite thing for me to say this, but, you know, we spend so much of our lives, you know, every night we put ourselves into this state of unconsciousness and we dream and, you know, we go into this other kind of world. We're always, even in our waking life, there are interactions between what's actually happening in front of us, but then how we're processing those thoughts and how those thoughts are connecting up with other associations, consciously and unconsciously, you know. And I think that Lanek is about, in a way, the relationship between the conscious and the unconscious mind, and how those two things are always sort of moving in and out of, you know, they're moving in a dance with each other, you know, they're moving in dialogue with each other. And as a child, I suppose, you know, that's something that feels very, very natural. You know, the you know, an object you pick up, you know, a leaf you pick up off the ground can be a leaf, but it can also be, you know, a spaceship, you know, with it, and it can just sort of oscillate between those things very easily for you. Whereas, you know, you grow into adulthood and you have different priorities and, you know, your mind works in a slightly different way, it's harder to kind of tap into that to a degree. But I do think that objects and things around us still have resonances and associations that we're not always in control of either. And I think that the way that Lanek goes from Unthank into Glasgow and back into Unthank again, and from Lanek to Thor and back to Lanek again, I think the first time I read it, when I got to the Thor part, it was a bit jarring, for sure. It's like, wait, how come I'm suddenly in a kitchen sink novel now? It's really weird. But then it just started to make a lot of sense. And, you know, once you can see also the little allusions within the text, you know, to, you know, there's a lot in the Thor part about water and about, you know, rivers flowing, water flowing, which he gets echoed later in the novel. Of course, you know, there's a whole thing about eczema and then there's the dragon hide, you know, and the skin diseases and so on. So you can see, you know, you can see the parallels after a while. But I like Lanark as a piece. You know, I love it as both things. I think it would be a brilliant book if it was split into two, but it wouldn't have quite the same kind of like magic that it does.
And I think that was, you know, over the years, I think he had various publishers who wanted that to happen, but he was dogged and even just the ordering of it. I think, like you're saying from the start, there's that jar of have I started at the wrong section, or that constant sort of second guessing yourself. But that's a nice way to describe it, the conscious and the unconscious, and that, and also the way you described it in relation to children, that kind of wonder that they have and that ability so quickly to shift something from what the real function to something else, which I don't think Alistair really fully ever, you know, lost. He still had that, that, you know, people describe it as a kind of childlike quality, but it was this sort of magical way of still being able to read things in those different ways, I think, is
important. Yeah, I mean, I think it's very unfortunate that when people describe that quality as being childlike, there's always this sort of, it's always freighted with this sort of association of like naivety or being a bit simple or something, which I really, really think is missing the point. Yeah. You know, whenever I go on the subway or walk down the street, I always think like every single person here, almost every single person has at one point in their life, probably when they're about 6 or 7 years old, made something. They've made a piece of art. You know, they've made a drawing, or they've made a funny lump with some plasticine, or whatever it is. Everyone has had that experience. It is within in everyone's personal, you know, life history. And at a certain point, that kind of gets pushed aside as being, you know, oh, you know, that's not the thing that you must, you know, you can put those things aside as an adult, you know, and you know, it's going to be your hobby from now on. But I think it's down there. It's deep within all of us. And I think that it just manifests itself in adult life in different ways.
Lockdown has made a lot of people rediscover that, I think, hasn't it? That lockdown has prompted a lot of people to, in many ways, like what we're kind of talking about, look at the local. So you've got a small area in which you're able to commute and get out and about and take beauty in observing those small details around you, but also this idea of so creativity being so important, having an outlet to try and in some way make sense of what's going on at the moment. I think it feels like that's been quite important. A lot of people have discovered, whether that's just having time to read a book or, you know, taking up drawing or, I don't know, just making.
Yeah. I mean, those, you know, those things are sort of, they're also very kind of complex, aren't they? Because, you know, the child has time to do that because all the other things in their life are taken care of, like, you know, paying rent and where to get food. And, you know, of course, as an adult, you know, you have these other priorities which you have to worry about. So to a certain degree, you know, it's a byproduct of leisure. But I don't think that means that people, you know, I still think of the people's minds, which we can never really fully know, you know, are still engaged in that, even if it's just like when they're going for a jog around the park. It might be the only moment they get to themselves. It's still a moment to themselves for everything to sort of be processed. And yeah, and that attention, you know, that attention to the local. It reminds me of something I read in an interview with Alistair, where he, I think it was from around the time that Lanark came out, and some rather snotty interviewer was saying something about, do you think people will be put off Lanark because it references Glasgow and local place names too much? Mm-hmm. And he said, and you know, he says like, well, you're here talking to me. Mm-hmm. So obviously it interests you enough for that. But then he points out that, you know, like Dante was always putting, you know, Italian politics into his writing, you know, and like, you know, in the Divine Comedy, there's a lot of like local stuff that was happening in Florence, mm-hmm. going on in that. You know, it happens throughout literature. It happens, you know, it happens everywhere.
Yeah.
You know, I think that you draw from your immediate surroundings.
But yeah, I think it was harder maybe for other people to perceive that, who were, you know, like you were saying earlier, this it wasn't deemed as a centre, was it, Glasgow in any way? It was seen as probably a bit of a parochial situation, what was happening up there. So I guess it's more, it shines more of a light on maybe the interviewer with that question and analysis.
Yeah, I mean, that's what I was sort of trying to say earlier on when I was mentioning, you know, the idea of sort of localism and parochialism. There are certain locales imagine themselves to be universal, mm-hmm. whereas other local places know that they are not, and they make, you know, make a virtue of that. You know, they make that into, like, you know, a strength. And you know, I think that that's another fascinating thing about Alistair, is that, you know, he is absolutely committed to this very specific place, the city of Glasgow, and, you know, more broadly, of course, you know, his commitment to Scottish politics as well, but and Scottish nationalism and independence, sorry. I think there's something about that I really like. You know, it's counter to a more contemporary model of the contemporary artist. Well, who knows what that will be now, post-pandemic, but at least pre-pandemic, of, you know, the jet-setting artist who'd be sort of, you know, invited to do a biennial here and an exhibition there and flying all over the world, dropping in here, dropping in there, doing a project, you know, and then leaving again. Which all sort of seems, you know, terribly glamorous, but is actually kind of very, very problematic. And I think that, you know, the idea of, like, committing, you know, your life to this place and really sort of trying to make it better in a way, whether that's through, you know, your public artworks like Alistair did, or just the way you kind of are within a community and how you represent them, I think is really interesting and inspiring too.
Oh, absolutely, totally agree with that kind of community that you foster. And yeah, the city almost was, it's not his canvas, but it's that idea of publicly citing these things, right, releasing them and then being out there, and of value and access to everyone, I think is really important. And that's ultimately what he's done for Glasgow. You know he created something. Well, you know, he wasn't the only one, of course, there was peers and people around him, but it was okay to stay there and to make something out of what was around. And there's real ripples that kind of flowed.
I think I really love about the book A Life in Pictures, you know, especially the early sections of the book where he's just talking about all the things that inspired him as a child and then as a young man and as an art student. And, you know, it's the civic architecture, it's books he found in the library, and, you know, and things that, you know, passed through the city. And I think that's the same for many artists. You know, it's the bricks and mortars around you are very, very valuable resources in lots of different kinds of ways.
Yeah, absolutely. Dan, have you got a passage you'd like to read or share?
Yeah, I mean, one of the interesting things about the Grey Day readings were how people gravitated towards, you know, certain passages and so on. And as they were unfolding and I was trying to think about what to read, you know, to watch someone's reading and go, oh, damn, I was going to read that bit. I don't know. I mean, I've been sort of in two minds. I love the opening chapter, The Elite. I just think it's so, so evocative and just brimming with drama. It's absolutely incredible. So I was sort of vacillating between that and then this other bit in the Thor section about the walk that Thor and his friend McAlpin do into the Cowcaddens, which I think maybe given a conversation, maybe I'll read that bit if it's all right. I know someone else, maybe a couple of people did for the Grey Day reading, so I hope you don't mind me.
No, absolutely.
Okay. One morning, Thor and McAlpin went into the Cowcaddens, a poor district behind the ridge where the art school stood. They sketched in an asphalt play park till small, persistent boys, "What are you writing, mister? Are you writing a photo of that building, mister? Will you write my photo, mister?" drove them up a cobbled street to the canal. They crossed the shallow arch of a wooden bridge and climbed past some warehouses to the top of a threadbare green hill. They stood under an electric pylon and looked across the city centre. The wind, which stirred the skirts of their coats, was shifting mounds of grey cloud eastward along the valley. Travelling patches of sunlight went from ridge to ridge, making a hump of tenements gleam against the dark towers of the city chambers, silhouetting the cupolas of the Royal Infirmary against the tomb-glittering spine of the necropolis. "Glasgow's a magnificent city," said McAlpin. Why do we hardly ever notice that? "Because nobody imagines living here," said Thor. McAlpin lit a cigarette and said, "If you want to explain that, I'll certainly listen." "Then think of Florence, Paris, London, New York. Nobody visiting them for the first time is a stranger, because he's already visited them in paintings, novels, history books, and films. But if a film hasn't been used by an artist, if a city hasn't been used by an artist, not even the inhabitants live there imaginatively. What is Glasgow to most of us? A house, a place we work, a football park or golf course, some pubs and connecting streets, that's all. No, I'm wrong. There's also the cinema and library. And when our imagination needs exercise, we use these to visit London, Paris, Rome, under the Caesars, the American West at the turn of the century, anywhere but here and now. Imaginatively, Glasgow exists as a music hall song and a few bad novels. That's all we've given to the world outside. It's all we've given to ourselves. I thought we'd exported other things, ships and machinery, for instance. Oh yes, we were once the world's foremost makers of several useful things. When this century began, we had the best organized labor force in the United States of Britain. We had John McLean, the only Scottish school teacher to tell his students what was being done to them. He organized the housewives' rent strike here on Clydeside, which made the government stop the landlords getting extra money for the duration of World War I. That's more than most prime ministers have managed to do. Lenin thought the British Revolution would start in Glasgow. It didn't. During a general strike, a red flag flew on the city chambers over there. A crowd derailed a tram car. The army sent tanks into George Square. But nobody was hurt much. Nobody was killed, except by bad pay, bad housing, bad feeding. McLean was killed by bad housing and feeding in Barlinnie Jail. So in the 30s, with a quarter of the male workforce unemployed here, the only violent men were Protestant and Catholic gangs who slashed each other with razors. Well, it is easier to fight your neighbors than fight a bad government. And it gave excitement to hopeless lives. Before World War II started, so Glasgow never got into the history books, except as a statistic. And if it vanished tomorrow, our output of ships and carpets and lavatory pans would be replaced in months by grateful men working overtime in England, Germany, and Japan. Of course, our industries still keep nearly half Scotland living around here. They let us exist. But who nowadays is glad to just exist? I am, at the moment, said McAlpin, watching the sunlight move among rooftops. So am I, said Thor, wondering what had happened to his argument. After a moment, McAlpin said, so you paint to give Glasgow a more imaginative life? No, that's my excuse. I paint because I feel cheap and purposeless when I don't. I envy your purpose. I envy your self-confidence. And just rereading that, actually, the stuff about the social conditions and about, you know, sectarian violence, I mean, that just sort of feels so resonant now with so many, you know, so many divisions in society. I just think that, yeah, I mean, that's the richness of Lanark, is that you keep going back to it, and there are more and more things that you can find in there. You know, the passage that I read for the Grey Day readings was near the end about the deluge, and you know, that also sort of feels so sort of prescient for our kind of troubled climate, you know, change times.
Absolutely, what a lovely reading, though, to end a really fascinating conversation, Dan. I really appreciate you taking time.
Well, thanks for inviting me. It's just a pleasure to think about this work. Brilliant.
I've always felt that stories and pictures were a way of keeping people I knew alive and as they were.